morning, I'll reconvene the meeting. Mr. Goldsmith, for a variety of people. Before you start, I could tell you that we have the famous name of this area of Franklin Flats North, because we're getting a bit of a mouthful referring to this butters and options in front of us, the name. So.
That's our internal thing. That doesn't matter, our emails, Commissioner, so that's Franklin Flats North. Appearing as you're told from legal submissions, Commissioners, on behalf of the five names submitted, the name on the front page of both the legal submissions lodged in writing and the summary submissions just lodged. Appearing with Ms. Hill, with the submitters, and Mrs. Lindy Hansen here, who's one of the submitters, and Mr. Nance Ferguson planning, Mr. Deadly Lance Adams, Andy Hart, traffic. Three witnesses, three summaries. Yeah. Starting this year has been about a question of time, about how much we've got and what we have to present. It is, Commissioners, in my view, one of the more tangled rezoning scenarios that might be facing it. It has a bunch of strange factual background factors which are potentially relevant. I actually intend to spend some time taking you through some of those, because at the end of the day, especially if you made all the facts on the ground, and there's a lot of facts and background factors here which are potentially relevant to this rezoning. So I'm going to refer you to a bundle of documents which have been handed around, and as I go through them, you'll see the rationale for that. But the point is, I'm trying to evade as much as possible the information that I believe is potentially appropriate to your decision on the rezoning. Fairly lengthy legal submissions that have been pre-lodged. I'm going to take those as read. I don't intend to go through them. I tend to like to bring further detailed submissions in writing and then just speak to points as you know, become aware. A three-page summary which has been handed around, and basically they're talking points that I'm going to refer to in some more detail. So paragraph one just introduces it. Now, paragraph two, this is a joint case on behalf of five unrelated submitters who lodged unrelated submissions relating to different, small or larger areas of land. I don't know whether, it just occurred to me, whether you managed to pick up from a fairly complex section 43 report who owns what, but I think of the plan of the five landowners and their landholdings, and that would be of assistance to you.
Yes, I'd
like a copy of those. Thank you. Okay. Just referring to that quickly, colour-coded blue, the arts. Well, sorry, just to the left of the blue, the dotted blue is the Transpower substation site. Then blue is the Arnott's. Orange is the Hansen Family Trust. And that orange includes the slightly less orange, yellowy bit adjoining the highway, which is the area under the airport's out of control boundary. Green is FII Holdings Limited. Pink, Universal Villas Limited. It's the Hockington. To be here today, you may turn up later. And then Jandell Trust owns that little, again, orangey bit that's completely surrounded on three sides by Universal. Total area 26.1 hectares, and it comprises all of the land that was zoned NBR in the notified place, the entire land. Now, at the outset, Commissioners, I was actually two of the five submissions, and as I sat down and looked at the submissions and looked at the other submissions that had been lodged and thought about you being faced with a range of individual submitters with individual ideas and objectives, we felt in terms of our, we have an obligation to the panel to try and assist the panel to facilitate its decision making, so call this my cat herding plot. We got enough from everybody else and put forward the proposition of a joint presentation. So it costs obviously my presentation, I make it easier for the panel. Degree of consultation round with everybody up. Difficulties then were that there were a variety of individual submissions, seeking a variety of different outcomes, and various landowners having a variety of individual objectives for their land, some specific, some more general in the sense of, there are some developers here, some people who are likely to develop their own land, particularly the eastern half. Universal developments, as you're aware, is a land hopping, Mr. Hocking is a land developer, you appear to come to Spear Heights and want it, Mr. Hocking. Aside from FIA Holdings, Paul Horrell, one of the major local contractors. If you dig to the side, you'll see this kind of semi-contractor yard activities happening on that land. But then we have the Orange Hanson Family Trust, who is a lot of big time developer. And probably unlikely to be the long-term developer of that land. And the artists who, interestingly enough, although I'm still appearing fully with the sold land, something else. So no idea what their plans are. These just happen on the way through. Looking at the objectives and the submissions lodged, we then went through the zones of district plan and discovered, almost by happy accident, as it were, the business mixed use zoning would give all of the landowners, or each of the landowners, what they sought to achieve. We had a range of objectives from residential to business, to commercial, and it just so happened that the BNX zone, the BMU zone, gave everybody, all those five submitters, what they would like to achieve through the zoning of their land. So I canvassed the option of presenting a joint case for the BMU zoning on the basis that it would meet everybody's objectives. Now, obviously, your zoning decisions aren't dictated by what people want, but in my submission, there was a starting point that the river landowners get together and can come up with a solution that would suit their objectives, and if there are no planning reasons or landscape reasons or other valid RMA reasons not to impose that zoning, then perhaps a reasonable starting point is the zoning that the landowners are seeking. Section 9 of the Act, they know they can use their land as they wish, subject to constraints under plans. So I put to you the BMU zoning point just as the starting point, which would, as it happens, meet the various objectives of the submitters. Funny enough, it would also be the objectives of the Otago Foundation Trust Board, but I'm not representing them, they're the only other submitter in this area, because I think the evidence says so, the Foundation Trust Board has entered into a contract to buy part of that Orange land off the Hanson Family Trust. And I think that evidence, I'm sure the Brent has their claim of a church and some units. It's in the fund. The other aspect of this was, in thinking about it, the other business mixed use zoning being the Gorge Road zoning, was actually a number of interesting parallels between the two areas of land. They're both on the edge of an urban area. They both could reasonably or logically be rezoned for commercial or residential zoning, given their location. Either or both zones would make sense. They are both areas of land with constraints, particularly on amenity. Gorge Road, it's the side of a major highway, it's under a cliff. The Gorge Road wind comes howling through. It's probably not the land you'd immediately, would be immediately obvious for residential zoning. But then again, worker housing, accommodation, close to town, walking distance, not everybody can have their house on the sunbeam slopes of Kelvin Heights. So it's not unsuitable for residential, but there are amenity issues. And this land, this one is similar. It is beside a major highway. It is south-facing, flat and south-facing rather than north. It has a crosswind runway affecting it, and little aircraft going overhead. There are a range of constraints which suggest, well, it might be for residential, could be developed for residential, there's plenty of people who are happy for the side highways and underneath runways. But commercial zoning across the road. Commercial residential straight across the road. So there was just a number of factors that suggested to us that, business rescue starting at Gorge Road out here, and you look at all the objectives and policies, they all make sense, and they all fit. Which is why this presentation, I think, seems to make no changes to objective policies at the time. It really attempts to have some particular rules applicable to this area. So, that's the background to this joint presentation, and the background to our thinking behind what we started off with and wanted to put to you. Point three, I'll just touch on the location, the big picture of this land. It's on the Frankton Flats. The Frankton Flats has rapidly become urbanised and commercialised, as I'm sure you're aware, by the zoning. People coming to Queenstown from the west, coming on Neighbours Mile. God knows, that's going to end up looking. There's a big debate before council this week as to how much urban development is going to be on the Neighbours Mile. Comes down the cutting across that, I think everyone would say, lovely sweeping bridge through the ONF of the Shotover River. If you ignore the sewage treatment plant just down to the left and the line of white industrial buildings which lines the terrace above you as you drive in. But you're coming into the town. There's an intersection with Tucker's Beach Road just past the bridge, which I'm going to come to a bit later on, where there's a major intersection upgrade plan. So there's going to be a major intersection there. You come up the slope, and then you hit the Franklin Flats and you hit the dock. So the big picture says you've already come into the town, you've already come past the urban edge, and you're coming into the Franklin Flats, which in 5, 10, 15 years is going to look very different from the way it looks now. To a greater lesser degree, it's going to have development down both sides of it. And that's kind of and of course there's the EAR roundabout, what I call the SH6 roundabout. The SH6 roundabout has kind of changed its name. But we have this major roundabout right at the entry to this area of land. Currently got three legs, going to have a fourth leg, designed for a fourth leg. Another major factor in terms of what's the appropriate use of this land. Some other factors, of course, especially the universal land up on the, it's above the road, it's on a flat, the road goes down, it's up on a kind of, it's on a flat terrace, but the highway going west goes down away from it. We have the FIO holders on the land next door with that big earth berm, which by way of background was constructed in accordance with an association with NZTA who wanted to widen the road, and because of land. NZTA needed land, and they needed to have some land offers to occupy the holdings, and that berm or that planting came out of the NZTA consultation. So we have a big picture of this area of land sitting on the north of the Frankton Flats, an area that's rapidly de-urbanised. Point four, I just touch on, I won't repeat, dealt with the legal submissions, the scope. We agree with banks that he has spoken to anything on the submissions that have been lodged. There's one submission seeking that the rural zoning be retained, right through to EMU zoning, HBR zoning. In fact, as the pointed out, the rural zoning will be the least intensive, EMU is probably the most intensive. And in the ranges of relief and the ranges of requests for my submission, you have any outcome or any mixture of outcomes open to you in terms of jurisdiction. And I remind you of the case law that your task is to approach rezoning it as a clean sheet of paper. So there's no preconception, there's no starting point, there's no assumption, no default that the rule general is good and there has to be a reason to change away from it. You have a clean sheet of paper to decide the appropriate zoning. Point five, I highlight the three primary considerations which are advanced by council witnesses in opposition to the full rezoning of the site. All three considerations advanced are challenged in these submissions and the evidence. The first was the ONL boundary and related landscape considerations, where the council considers that over half the site should be left rural, primarily because of ONL landscape reasons. The second is the impacts on the SH6 roundabout traffic. and that was a matter of evidence, and we'll touch on that further. And the third is the alleged lack of need for more commissioners own land. Those are the three primary reasons, as I read the council's case, which together lead to the zoning recommendation that is before you. I then start off with, on those three topics, O&L and landscape considerations. And I start referring to a bundle of documents. The first one was scored a week ago, so I don't spend too much time on it, but that's the same excerpt from C180/99, attachment A, and I highlighted outstanding, conspicuous, remarkable, and so maybe they never said about being outstanding. I highlighted the point that outstanding is in relation to this district, that when you are determining an O&L and the boundaries of an O&L, they're talking about what is outstanding on the basis of this district. And the third main point on page 57 of that extract was the comment that usually an outstanding natural landscape should be so obvious in general terms there is no need for expert analysis. And I made the point last week and I repeat it, that there is possibly a starting position that if you have two experienced landscape architects disputing whether an area is part of an O&L, then clearly it's not obvious, and that may be a signal that makes that area, that's just a signal, that that area may not be appropriately part of the O&L. Now, you have evidence from Dr. Reed, you have evidence from Mr. Bentley, I'm sure you'll ask some questions to Mr. Bentley. At the end of the day, where that boundary is a matter of determination by you based upon the evidence you hear. Now, I have, in case maybe your assistance, particularly to Commissioners now for the court, that there have been a long series of landscape cases determining O&L boundaries. I'm not going to take you through all of them because each one of them really turns on its facts. But I thought it pertinent, an extra B to my bundle, there's two pages from Waterston vs. Kill DC. The Waterston decision was the first decision after C180/99 that dealt with a specific land boundary in a specific area. It just happens to be the first one. And I've only excerpted the front page and page 6, paragraph 10. But preceding that, there was the court assessed the evidence of Mr. Gibbett, who wanted a higher boundary, and the evidence of Mr. Baxter, who was proposing a lower boundary. Interestingly, Commissioners, this Waterston case is on the northern side of Perivale. We're on the southern side, this is on the northern side. I'm going to show you a map shortly, I'll show you exactly where it is. It's on the northern side of Ferry Hill. And I'm just going to read from paragraph 10. And there was a debate about topography and should a change in topographical, a change in kind of a slope down onto a flat be an appropriate line. And the court said, in our view, there are four circumstances that suggest the topographical line should give way for a recognition of the realities of the situation. The first is that there are, due, it appears, to earlier resource consents granted by council, two houses up by the line of poplars, as we described earlier. That factor was directly relevant for this case. And indeed, there is a third house site also on the lower slopes, although that has not yet been built on. All three houses, if a third is built, will be within the O&L, as Mr. Evans assessed it. Certainly the presence of houses does not automatically disqualify a landscape from being an outstanding natural landscape, but it is a factor to be considered. Secondly, the land's naturalness has also been reduced by the fact that it is sown in exotic green grasses, and most of the trees on it, most notably the poplars, are exotic and deciduous. The third aspect for us to consider is that immediately to the east of the site, that second aspect has a certain relevance here, when if you on site and look at the water race in the land above and below. The third aspect for us to consider is moving to the east of the site of Mr. Broomfield's land. That contains some rural residential subdivision already. Indeed, it transpired at the hearing the council had approved further subdivision of that land, although it admitted to Mr. Innes when he prepared his evidence. Again, potentially relevant to this case because we have quiet rise zoning adjoining the land we're talking about. And fourthly, if we take all of those matters into account and the need for a practical boundary between the outstanding natural landscape and the vision of any landscape, not just across the Ferrers land, but also across adjacent properties on Ferry Hill, leading to the change of slope at the row of poplars as the place to draw the line. Now, and all of the cases that followed basically follow the same kind of theme: topography, vegetation, development, cultural overlays, all of those factors go into the consideration of an ONL boundary in a specific location. Obviously, the facts change on each one, but all of those factors get taken into account. And there's also a bit of a theme that runs through the cases that started here about having a practical boundary. Not necessarily purely purist, but in some places, you've got to be a little bit practical or pragmatic, because, as is frequently said, landscapes don't suddenly change from ONL to whatever one below us. There's always a transition. And if you have to get a boundary running around the map, there will always be areas where you have to take a bit of a pragmatic, practical approach. And all of that comes from this first case and the series of following cases.
I wonder if you could help me with another aspect that you haven't covered, but there was a later decision, and I can't remember the number, but it was the Upper Environmental Society decision, where the court held that a landscape that was an area of rural land had to be sufficiently large to be a landscape before it could have a separate classification.
I know the one I mean.
That's the Sharpridge, I think.
It isn't Sharpridge. It's the case about the area of land beyond Wanaka.
Yes.
Heading towards the Lutoki. That valley.
Yes. That's right.
And we argued that was a BAL landscape, and of course it was too small.
Yes.
The landscape ran from the mountains into the lake.
Yes. I just wondered if you would like to address that in this instance, just right, as to whether we end up here. We draw the line in certain places, might we end up with an area which isn't big enough to be a landscape, and whether that is still a relevant matter.
Now, this is the issue that I touched on in Gertrude last week. I didn't expand it.
Yes.
In addressing it, I start from the current operative plan, where we have three categories. ONLs and ONS, because 10 metres in this one. Visual amenity landscape, and upper rural landscape. And all of the cases, which I'm right in saying, no, I won't say that, I am wrong. There was that case in Wanaka, where they talked about the size of the landscape, the proposed VAL. A similar finding was made in the Fordyce Farms case in Little Trove, where the court held that Fitzpatrick Bowl wasn't big enough to be a VAL.
And then Cadrona,
they said the valley floor wasn't big enough, or was it part of the whole landscape? And of course, it was Hawthorne, where they found that the triangle and surrounds were actually big enough to be a separate OR. That line of authority was then complicated by the High Court in Trident, and Trident was the case just above the top of Queenstown Hill. There was a small patch of land which contained about four house sites, which was within the identified ONL on the planning acts. We argued at council level that in fact that small patch was part of the adjoining urban landscape, and the line should be drawn above the patch of four houses or four house sites, and the council accepted that. The High Court, on interpreting the district plan, said, well, the way this plan reads, if you're rural, you have to be one of the three. So you can't have a small piece of urban landscape if it's own rural. And the High Court held that the little area of land was an ORL. And it's only sort of It's literally four housemates. The High Court held, if you interpreted the cabinet, if you interpreted the leadership panel properly, if it wasn't ONL or VAL, then you have a default category of ORL and can be a postage stamp. So the High Court kind of overruled the Environment Court implied we were actually correct on that issue. That case was followed by the one at the end of Beacon Point Road in Wanaka. It's on the Canning Max. There's a little,
yes,
there's one little site that's an ORL. And that case, I'm pretty sure, followed private. Because I said, it isn't part of the late ONL. It can't be part of the town urban land. There's a little bit of land on the end of Lynch. It can't be part of the town urban landscape because of private. If it's got to be an ORL.
Or you put an ORL thing.
Other rural landscape.
It was the default
category. Sorry? The default. It became the default category. And in fact, we are sitting in one of those, I'm fairly sure, that, the land we're dealing with today was a case, the Franklin Flats case, there was a Franklin Flats case that held that before the zone was put in place, the whole of the Franklin Flats was an ORL. And then they rezoned in 1900 and left this little piece of flat land that we're dealing with today in the slides, which wasn't ONL, it was the remnant of the ORL of the Franklin Flats, quite hot because the rest of the land had been rezoned, so it's a town landscape category. I'm going to come to the landscape line here, but between the highway and the ONL is this area of land. So we're actually dealing with the remnant of ORL. Now, the solution I touched on and didn't develop last week was that if you're under the regime, you must identify the ONS, you must identify the ONLs, and everything left over is rural landscape. And I just raised a question mark, and I maintain that question mark as to whether I think the court's jurisdiction on size of landscape may also be relevant to an ONL, although most of us are big, but you never get there. But once you've determined your ONL by the factors and found your boundaries, everything else is rural. So I don't think the case law on the size of the landscape is an assistance in determining the zoning of this piece of land. Sorry, the landscape categorisation of this piece of land. In my submission, you must determine the ONL, you must determine the appropriate boundary of the ONL, and what is left, of course, you probably aren't going to get any rural left, but as you go through your decision making, before you decide on the zoning, you determine the landscape boundary, and quite frankly, whether you take the council's case on ONL or our case on ONL, you still end up with this little piece of rural land, which isn't ONL, which you are then invited to rezone. So it doesn't matter whether you see our case or the council's case.
Right.
Unless you extend the ONL to the right. The only way you could avoid that would be have the ONL come right down to the right. But if you accept the council's ONL boundary, or our proposed ONL boundary, or a compromise on the suggestion, at that point, and before you do your rezoning, you have an area of rural landscape classification which you then decide to zone off.
Well, you have an area with no zoning and then you decide to zone it.
Well, I'm not sure whether you theoretically at the moment there was no zoning. Does the operative rural stage when you make
well,
that decision?
Well, I think if we're starting with a clean sheet, we have to start with the landscapes.
Yes.
And then build up. Once we've determined where the landscape lines are, then we determine what zoning is applicable.
Correct.
And I think that's the best way to approach it.
Yes. I don't think the size of the landscape is the
your submission on that, so we are more understood.
Thank you. I then, now, I've annotated these things, A to Z, and then X and Y to this. X and Y are A3 pages. So I could ask you to go to X. And I've commented it in my summary that it's lived and okay to get 30 to 1 A. I forget where it came from, but it's her exhibit. I've put the word annotated because the pink line, if you open to the hard copy page, the pink line is mine and the black line is mine.
Just to help you listen, we actually asked for this. This is her first revelation. There's a more recent one, which has some other things shown as well. That's fine for your purposes.
I found a very useful plan, which is one that I'm going to talk to.
That's what we asked for.
And I want to talk about the O&L line. Particularly the council's recommended O&L line. And it's that brown dotted line. Round green. And let's start from the right hand side where the brown or bandy green line comes in from the right hand margin and then turns sharply downwards, heading downwards to the word trench hill road. Now, as I understand the memoranda that have been flying around, that bit of the line is not within jurisdiction in this hearing because it's been filed last. It doesn't actually come from any, it's just it's been created for the purpose of this hearing, it doesn't come from anywhere else previously. So I'm not sure that it has any particular relevance given it's outside your jurisdiction. I could ask the questions about why it suddenly changes. I mean, my immediate question would be why does it suddenly change according to the downside when it could continue along the general topographic plan? But
we'll worry about that when we clarify.
So if we start the council's line at Trench Hill Road, for some reason it starts off by going directly down slope. Nothing on either side of it makes any difference. It just goes straight down the hillside. Question mark, why? So it goes down the hillside, we know why, because the green wasn't to get to the bottom of the hill. But I just make the point that at the point where you're starting, there's no differentiating characteristic on either side of that line. The vertical bit. So that kind of runs along underneath the proposed HIF road, which is what it comes in. It kind of vanishes for a while. And then if you keep going to the left, it diverts away from that slope. And the 366, for some reason, it goes diagonally down through a flat pack. Now there's no contour line there at all, so why it didn't go along the bottom of the slope, I have no idea. But it diverts down through a flat paddock. It then continues to the left through an equally flat paddock. No contour lines at all. No differentiation of land on either side of it in any way, shape or form. Continues going to the left where it crosses the HIF road again. We're still on basically flat country. I mean, those are very wide contour lines here. That's the flat land. So why it's out in the middle of the flat, I don't know. Then it continues going and it kind of comes back to the bottom of the slope, which I think is the basic rationale, if I understand Dr. Reed. Then for some reason it goes between two transpower towers, which I think are pretty much at the same level. So why it goes between two transpower towers, given the whole thing's about over now, there's a bit of a puzzle. Then it continues along, sort of it looks like around the bottom of the slope. And then when it hits the blue line, it climbs, it does a big climb up through some contours for some reason. It doesn't go around the bottom. It climbs the hill beneath the blue line, and then it seems to come out of the blue line where it dives down again and a whole bunch of contours for some reason. Then it goes across another flat bit for some reason. And then it suddenly turns the corner and goes right up a whole bunch of contours to join kind of with the left of my black lines. Now, I'm not making evidence, I'm just pointing the factors, commissioners, but I just ask you to consider how much thought has gone into that line. Where is the landscape? It's all very well to say bottom of the hill, big picture, and forget all the detail. But quite frankly, right in the middle, where it goes through the flat land, takes a big chunk of land out of it. Mr. had a Mr. Hockey's land, and if I own this land. That land, ideal for development, for some reasons in the RL. So my general comment in relation to that line is I just ask you to consider the factual justification of that line as the boundary of that outstanding natural landscape, bearing in mind the case of Waikutsi. Now, just to make the comparison easy, I marked on this plan a pink line, which is Mr. Bentley's water race line. At some point, you're going to have to come up with a line. I don't think there's any challenge, if we go to the left-hand end of my black line, at the point where the red urban growth boundary meets the grounds of lower level, to the left of there, I don't think there's any argument. So if you've got to get from, in your decision-making, you've got to get from that point across to Quail Rise. And you obviously have to decide on the facts where you think that OML boundary is. Mr. Bentley's opinion is that the reasons here is best evidence, and I'll repeat in the summary, the water race is a more logical, sensible, and practical and identifiable line running across the landscape, above which there is undoubtedly nothing but OML, and below which there are a range of cultural overlays and items, including the transmission lines, the four lines of subdivision, which I'm about to come to, and a whole bunch of other things happening further down. So that's his view of where the OML line should be.
What is the black one?
I haven't heard. Well, the story here, just leave that open, leave the X open, and go to attachment C, which is the Hanson Family Partnership 4-lot subdivision. Decision. I've included the whole decision, but if I talk to the front page first, I just note the date there is 30 August 2016, so it's late last year. Pretty much 2017. I put a note there, was a pier lodge relating to one condition relating to a walkway, unrelated to what we're talking about today, but I have noted that I lodged the signed consent memorandum on that appeal last week with the court. I attached to it an amended copy of the decision which reflects the agreed change to one condition. I've attached that amended decision. I put a note there that condition 5 is subject to the issue of an environmental consent order. It's a minor issue. All parties have agreed that consent order will issue within the next few days, or something next week or two. I do want you to, if you go right through the, unfortunately, that hasn't been patient, but there's the decision, if you come through, and the conditions, and towards the end, there's about three pages of plans at the back, and then go back a couple of pages, there's a condition 15, there's a heading ongoing conditions and consent notices. That's condition 15. If you turn the page, look at little C. Within lots 5 and 6, further buildings and structures should be limited to those associated with farms, such as fences, stockyards, and gates. Within lots 5 and 6. And you turn over one page, and on the back page, there's a subdivision plan. On the left-hand back page, there's a full subdivision plan. And you will see the four-lot subdivision has been approved, lots 1, 2, 3, and 4. You will see four building platforms marked AA, BD, CC, and DD. You will see above them the water race marked W and X. It's an existing easement if I put those across the page. And you will see above and around, in fact on three sides of the four residential lots is lot 5, containing 14 hectares. It's located, there's a strip between lot 1 and 2 and Hanson Road. at the top of the north, it goes across above the water race, and it takes in all of the land to the east, down to the cadastral boundary of the lands we're talking about. And then lot 6 is further down on the side of Hanson Road, it actually drops right down. The point I'm making here as a factor which might inform you as to an appropriate owner line is that the Hanson Partnership sterilised that land in this consent. And the presentation, I made a presentation, because just a bit of background, the 4 lots have been consented, the land surrounding it has been sterilised from further subdivision, and that was to avoid a possible argument that there'd be a precedent set for more houses up here, and this to be a walkway. The effort is going to spend about $100,000 piping that race and running a walkway from Hanson Road through to Quail Rise. So it was a major pedestrian cycling walking route connecting a major residential area through the Hanson Road and down the Franklin. That was part of the case presented. And that's now, and was a, the appeal was for irrigation because the decision is issued didn't require the race to be piped. All those would be on that track because those are the sidewalk races. And anyway, I appealed and the applicant agreed to pipe the race. And it was a lovely 3-metre wide track. I represent the Hanson Valley Trust. They do not want to be seen by proposing this pink O&L line on my attachment X as somehow creating a platform for more residential subdivision below the water race. They presented their case with 4 lots on the basis that there would be no further development up there. And where the 4 lots are, there's some vegetation and willows and 2 big gullies, and it's kind of broken up. Whereas to the east, it's a lovely smooth slope. The landscape characteristics are different. In fact, as an architect, and in fact, the same team was on that case. So they don't want to be seen as trying to get more development. Turning back to X, the suggestion I make for this panel, we stand by our evidence that the pink line would be on pure landscape terms, the appropriate O&L boundary. But if we added a bit of pragmatism to shift the O&L boundary from the pink line down to the urban growth boundary, the red line, it's quite simple. No objection from Hanson Trust who owns all that land. D, it would reflect the fact that the Hanson Family Partnership has tried to sterilise that land and maintain it in the O&L, or maintain it undeveloped. And if the O&L line came down to match the urban growth boundary cadastral, then that would, shall we say, further cement the restriction on further development that consent anticipates. Now I think it's interesting, because a black line is the environment course of O&L boundary. Now, if I can explain that, I then need to take you to I don't know whether the Toledo Town Commissioners are aware, but I don't know if you've read the C1899 recently, but it has an appendix. I'm opening up, this is a heritage item. This is going to be a frame.
You haven't let your wife see it.
My wife is a heritage specialist, she's going to be a heritage item. I'm going to. In C1899, in a nutshell, the court said, nobody's told us where the O&Ls are. How can we make a decision without first identifying the O&Ls? And no one's told us. So a lot of Judge Jackson, I'm not sure we're without commissioners, I just got in this car and went out and drove around Lockwood Basin with his pen. And he, and that's the appendix of Acts 1:8-99, where he basically said, in the essence, whoever was right in the other side. And did all these lies. And he had two categories of lies. He had solid black lines where you could have, we basically said, that is the line. And he had some dotted lines where he said, not sure here, hoping that heaven has been called. So that's the appendix, the original appendix, when I heard about 99. And there's then there were a series of landscape decisions which sorted out, there were arguments over some of these. He allowed me for anybody in the court evidence to change those lines. A whole bunch of decisions where some people tried to argue about it. There's a whole series of decisions, and all those decisions are recorded in the landscape categorisation maps that are at the back of the ODP, if you've got the ODP. Appendix 8. Appendix 8A. Important to understand that Appendix 8A are not planning maps that have been notified. They are merely a pictorial representation to assist readers in a whole series of environmental decisions. So if you want to find out where the no-read outline is, whether it's been determined by the court, you don't have to read 10 decisions, you only have to go to the council's informal maps. So that's the Appendix 2. Now, if you have Appendix D of my bundle, I have copied the relevant part of the map I've just shown you. And if you look very carefully, you see the Franklin arm, and in this Franklin, you see the built-up area of Franklin, you see the highway going along, and just on the, unfortunately, on the front of the page where it's my map's torn, you see Hanson Road coming off the highway and heading up towards the north. And you see the judges, or the court's, solid black line as to where the O&L boundary should be located in this area. Now, on my attachment X, I have tried the best I can to reflect the first part of that line. It's a very large, it's a very big scale map, it's a thick line, there's a little bit of guesswork involved, but if you actually carefully compare my Appendix B and each X and look at the distances, if you look at that Appendix B, the black line crosses Hanson Road just below the point where the road bends to the north. It goes from north, it goes from heading northeast to heading almost directly north. And then look at Appendix X. I've drawn my black line crossing Hanson Road just below the point where Hanson Road begins and gets to the north. So I'm pretty sure my black line is fairly accurate. Could be a couple of contours either way. The point I'm making is that when the Environment Court in C1009 made that determination. It's a determination of fact by the Environment Court. They didn't put the line at the bottom of the slope. They put the line about where, funnily enough, it actually happens to coincide with the UGB line. And the line across the final lines.
And roughly on the bottom.
Yeah. And roughly on the national map. They all come together. It's a finding of fact by the Environment. The other point is, Professor Music can confirm this, this land hasn't changed since 1999. This whole stretch of land looks now exactly as it looked in 1999. The substation was there, the artist's house was there, there's nothing on the Hanson land. The only the FIR Holdings berm wasn't there, there was a big row of trees.
I take that there were no challenges to the line in that area.
No, we had a debate. No, you're right. That line is taken straight from. Sorry. I think that line might be the Franklin Tracks decision. I need to check that. Either there hasn't been one, or the Franklin Tracks decision was determined the Franklin Tracks was no RL. It might come from, I'll check that, it might come from that decision. It's one of the two. There were no specific challenges to the line through the appeal process, I'm almost certain of that. And just because I said I would do it, on my next year D, if you look at my next year D and look at Ferry Hill, the Waterston case dealt with the solid back line on the northern side of Ferry Hill. Close on that, I leave the panel to consider the facts and the evidence, the landscape evidence. I invite you to consider my critique of Dr. Reed's O&L line. I invite you to consider our O&L line. I invite you to consider introducing the element of pragmatism, and I invite you to take into account the environment court's prior factual determination, which is not binding on you legally, but I think carries a bit of weight. And the fact, most importantly, that back then, the Environment Court essentially, instead of putting the line at the bottom of the hill, put the line kind of at the top of the slope to be kind of seen from the main line. I suspect that would be the reason for it. But that black line of mine, and it extends, it virtually follows the UGB boundary across. In fact, if I can just go back to an HD for a minute, if you look at the black line, and as it crosses Henson Road, it heads off across towards Quail Rise. You can see the waterways. The waterways are that line there. So if you go to the right hand end, where the black line comes to a stop, you look at the road and the waterways, and the black line is 2/3 to 3/4 of the distance between the road and the waterways. And you apply that 2/3 to 3/4 of the distance between the road and the waterways, it's about the UGB boundary, very close.
But you can actually also see the transpower lines on that map.
A lot of guidance there for your questions. But I think there's actually a lot more help there than you might have ever thought. And I thought it was worth taking you through it. The submitter's case remains regardless of the element of value determination of this mansion you rezoned anyway, for reasons which you have read and will hear further about. But there is a practical possibility of having a zone boundary, a UGB, and an O&L boundary, they're all sitting in the same place, which has a certain logic in my submission. So point 7, page 2, I've made that point. I've then turned to point 8, which is UGB and O&L. Highlight Ms. Kimberly Banks' position from her primary evidence. 1,150 residential units would have minimal effects on the SA Citroenica. Mr. Carr's position, which his summary is going to take his previous analysis one step further, he will say his calculations are that 1,075 residential units would constitute negligible risk for the SA Citroenica. Very close to those two figures. Point C, I just pose a question. Would a hypothetical residential development ever achieve that threshold? Mr. Carr's threshold works out at 41 residential units per hectare. Forgetting the transmission lines, forgetting the slope, forgetting the roading, or the big road that might go through. 41 units per hectare is quite, it's getting up there. As I said in my written submissions. It's above median density. It's achievable on this land, but you're going to have pretty intensive, pretty solid residential development to achieve 41 units per residential hectare. And of course, even HDR zoning doesn't require an outcome. It enables the outcome, but developers can do up to that. When you're getting the 41 units per hectare, that's kind of concrete apartments with lifts and a whole bunch of things. It isn't you do very well to achieve that with a more affordable kind of timber construction. At residential, I'm not sure whether the level that Ms. Banks and Mr. Carr say, well, the roundabout can easily handle, whatever they achieve, it might be, maybe. And of course, BMU zoning could take it further. My submission is that the critical issue is the extent of traffic generation. It's not the zoning which generates the traffic. So the point is not how you zone it. Our submission is the point is how much traffic do you allow? We say residential, BMU makes no difference if you have the right control. So at that point I turn to the rule we propose to address this issue. I want to go through that rule because it's important that we understand exactly what is intended. It's in the written legal submissions. I'll see you can find paragraph 84 commencing on page 23. And I have noted in my written submissions that I spent a lot of time on that rule before we wrote it, and of course some of you have observers and you find a problem with it, which is often the case. I think it's sometimes a bit unfortunate that we come to hearings like this where the council says no zoning, it doesn't do our but for this zone, here's our comments on the draft rule. And so we left, we're asking the commissioners to look at that. So the proposed rule, development of the BMU zone in Franklin for North State Highway 6 shall, most of this is carried forward from the existing MDR, no new grid vehicular access. Secondly, we're inserting not generate more than a total of 1430 vehicle movements, two way using the State Highway 6 4-4 roundabout during the evening weekday peak hour. That's Mr. Carr's threshold. He was asked to convert that into a per hectare basis on the basis that if we are going to rezone the land, there has to be some equity in how you allow this development at that place. And it's not appropriate to allow one developer to soak it all up and leave somebody else with nothing. So this formula translates to not generate more than 55 vehicle movements two way per hectare of land using the 6 Highway 6 Schofield Drive roundabout, using the evening peak hour, calculated in proportion and on the basis of the gross area of land being developed. So if you're developing 2.5 hectares of land, you're allowed 2.5 times 55. The note that I've added is a response to the evidence of NZTA when I realised that the way it was worded, it might be an ongoing thing. You've got to keep testing, which would be impractical. So the note says compliance with 2 and 3 above will be assessed and determined in accordance with specified traffic rates, which is the car advised, when resource consent is sought for any activity. Only residential activities, but I'll stop there. So the idea is under this rule, you apply, you do your traffic view, this is your proposed activity, you assess the anticipated traffic in that proposed activity, you do your calculation, if you get consent, you've got your consent. You don't have to keep measuring traffic. If you go back and expand your activity, you come back again under the rule. But the traffic calculation is done at resource consent time.
Just a technical point on that. Do you have a note or is it really a rule?
What's the status of the note?
The reality will be that within the second resource consent is applied for, there will be something established which will have been granted in accordance with it. How is account taken of what is actually happening as the development progresses? Because I bet it's on dollar and the predictions are perfect.
Well, if you come on for your second consent application, you must do a prediction in relation to what you're proposing.
And that will get you to yes or no.
Yes, and then I would have thought any prediction that's going to predict the effect on the roundabout, have to take into account what's already there, what's already happened.
Well,
because
they're three different tasks, don't they? One's assessing an effect, the actual effect post-development, and the other is doing a, it's a rule of thumb for getting to get one.
But the effect must be on the existing environment. And the existing environment will accommodate whatever's there now. And the discretion going to the bullet points is traffic effects on the roundabout and the potential concentration undermining public development. So I think the existing environment will capture whatever's happened.
Yeah, the problem I can see though, I think Mr. Crawford is the existing environment changes to the point where capacity is reached on the roundabout, but it still says you can comply with one or two, or two or three, by assessing the numbers in terms of the standard that NZTA was sort of report without. So you still meet the standard, even if the existing environment says you shouldn't do it. So when what is it in the rule, and perhaps it's something really should ask Mr. Ferguson to put his mind to, how to cover that off.
The starting point is the evidence of Ms. Banks and Mr. Carr that a roundabout one is supervised or equipment, so many don't move that negatively. So if three or four people develop in compliance with the rule, one would expect the number five to be able to do the same because of that baseline. If any of the earlier ones want to take more than their share, but they are assessed at this, under this rule, because they're going to have more, and one of the factors is you can't take away the development capacity from downstream. So the idea is, and of course one of the difficulties we have here, I'm going to come to this, is no one knows where this road's going to be built, or where it's going to go to, or where it's going to connect to, or what development might take place. I mean, you've seen the churches in place, what's in their evidence? Well, they're nowhere near 40 or less children as big. I mean, that consent to be notified as a hearing children. And if that consent happens, there's a big chunk of the zone that's going to have very little
happening. Very little effect in the weekday peak.
Yes. And it affects on Sunday, exactly. So somebody might come along later and say, well, they aren't using some of theirs. I'll do more here because I'll soak up some of their own use.
And that would be fine.
And that would be fine.
As long as it's within the threshold of...
Yeah, or if they're going over the threshold, they may be able to have an argument and say, well, look at where the church is built. Because of the fact that that area is actually a bit sphere, and we can use it here.
Right, I'm getting it, thank you.
Something to consider. And I don't know the answer, and I need to see that document, because there's a certainty involved. It's a question of certainty. Is that a document which is certain enough to support a permitted activity there? Is it open to
cards?
Yeah, well, Mr. Carroll is the first one, so I'm just thinking that at the moment.
Yes,
that
is
you. And I haven't seen the document. Well, I need to be more thorough.
And the other question is whether it should be, if we were to adopt that, whether it should be incorporated into the district plan by reference, so that it's clearly that document at that time, so that we don't get a situation where NZTA changed the numbers.
Yes, I agree. I mean, it was a kind of a starting point for that document. Something like the fact that we needed some sort of reference. I'm sort of worried about leaving it open and letting the council impose it instead of the council imposes from time to time. I think we need to put some structure.
No, because otherwise you'll get your end of the strategy engineer and the council's engineer in dispute.
Yes, yes.
Well, I think what you're trying to say is on something pretty much the same as what we have for parking standards. These activities need X amount of car parks, and in this one, these activities generate this amount of traffic. In fact, as I recall, far more district plans had that table on it, didn't it?
I'll ask Mr. Carr to think that he gives the evidence and answer questions about how certain that is. And then the paragraph 85, and I just got through that, and I rereading the rule in question, I realised that It's actually important to ensure that any proposed activity is assessed for its power generation potential to ensure the standards are reached. Although a health exemption could be made for residential development up to the threshold. So I consider that an additional activity rule is required for all activities, except activities that do not exceed the density of 40 residential units per gross hectare of land, should be a restricted discretionary activity to ensure that, other than that permitted level of development, anything was assessed in terms of traffic generation to make sure it didn't reach the standard. So, that's the short answer in our submission to the concerns about traffic, is that we know a certain level is acceptable. Beyond that, it should be assessed, and that can take into account a number of future uncertainties, development parameters, and who knows what else might come into it. So that's our response to the traffic concern. And then go to the alleged lack of need for additional commercial zoning. I made the same submission I made a week ago. That while need may be a significant factor in favour of zoning, my submission is not a significant factor, might not even be a factor at all, against zoning. The task for you on a clean sheet of paper is to determine the appropriate zoning of the land in question. A need may drive you to a zoning, but the lack of need does not by default mean rural. It's just a lack of need. There's a whole range of other factors that you should consider. 9B, I submit, is actually quite an important point. Council's DCM analysis demonstrates that well over 30 years of residential zoning capacity, but demonstrates a shortage of commercial zoning capacity after 20 years, which increases to 16.1 hectares shortage of allotable area within 30 years, by 2048. Before I even go to the National Policy Statement, which I'm about to go to, please ask you to think about that. We have here a request for zoning, a proposal for zoning, and a debate as to commercial versus residential or a mixture. Well, if the council's DCM analysis is we're going to keep some residential for 30 or 40 years, but we're going to run out of commercial within 20 years, surely that's a factor. Surely, if you're looking at the options here, you say, well, council has said that in 20 years' time, there will be a shortage of land for commercial zoning, and there's going to be 16 hectares required by 2048. Well, where are you going to find 16 hectares of land in 20 years' time in this basin for commercial zoning that's needed? I mean, speak about it. The mere fact that the council evidence discloses that future shortage, in my submission, must be a relevant factor in your consideration as to whether the VMU, which will allow residential and or commercial, is appropriate, or just residential, which excludes commercial. On the fact of facts, which is going to be significantly commercial in the future anyway. This is where all the commercial activities happen. But that's a fundamental issue, which I submit the Council's 43A report completely overlooks. There's a factor. Then we go to the National Policy Statement. Now, I'm not going to repeat my learned junior legal submissions on it. I'm an expert here on the NPS by now. But if you actually go through those policies, I'm not sure I'm going as far as saying they direct you that that is the only outcome, but I'm saying to you that when you read those policies that we've quoted and you look at it, this council is obligated to go through a process over the next 12 to 18 months to identify a development strategy to produce certain outcomes, short, medium, and long. The long term is 30 years. So, it has been, I'm not going to quote it all, but the standards that have to be met, all the definitions of work, and in my submission, under that National Policy Statement, which is after all a National Policy Statement, it's kind of lucky, it's coming pretty close to directing, well, that, when the Council gets what it has to do, and if we are at early stages, it directs the Council to what they have to do. It's a very powerful document. And one of them is to demonstrate in the long term, which is 30 years away, adequate supply of commercial land. Now, that has to be relevant to you when you're considering residential versus B and U. Because quite simply, if this land is zoned B and U, that's short of finished. They've got their 30 years. I mean, we're talking about 28 hectares. Logically, you'd have to think that some of it's more suitable for commercial and some of it's more suitable for residential. Just looking at commercial, probably the western end, just like the highway over the runway. You know, Mr. Hawkins' terrace behind the trees, it's lovely residential land. So, chances are on D&U, you're not going to get all residential or all commercial. Unlikely. So, if you can rezone now for D&U, but then when council comes to do its study, its detailed study into operating on its farm that incorporates all these figures, they're going to say, tick, we have commercial for 50 years. But without this, they don't.
And I think that Mr. enthusiasm may have actually created the opportunity for a return to that old age of the third zone. Deferred business study, for example, it's not needed until the year 25 or so. I force the landowner to wait. I mean, they used to do it from the evening. It's out of favour.
I think didn't I read some legal submissions from council advising you, council, for the council on the third zone? Quite recently read something that
they referred to it.
There's a recent case that the court kind of frowned on. I'm trying to think what it was. I read it in the last month or two. And the court was basically saying, well, creating the third zone creates an expectation. And you can be very careful about creating expectations that may never be met. I would argue, even if that was in play, and cover this, well, it's actually covered in, I didn't summarise it. If there were evidence that this land being zoned commercial would have adverse effects, it might be an argument for third zone. And we made the point in our written legal submissions, although Mr. Osborne carefully lists a series of potentially adverse effects of oversupply, isn't actually established at the end of the line. It's just a list of potentially adverse effects floating in the ether with no answers. It doesn't then say, and if you rezone this land BDMU, these adverse effects will follow. So there's no evidence that there'll be adverse effects. The other point made in the written submissions was that if their projections are right, and we have enough for the next 20 years, and an oversupply would have adverse effects, they'd be happy now. If we've got 20 years supply, we have an oversupply. So why aren't these alleged adverse effects happening right now? And why are the commercial rates in Queenstown and Franklin being driven to high levels if we have an oversupply? So, I don't believe there's a case of food zoning, because I don't believe there's any evidence that would suggest, evidence before you, that would suggest in any way that zoning this land BMU will have adverse effects, or even might have adverse effects. I'll leave that point there. I'll leave the MPS to you with detailed and legal submissions, but I submit to you that it's a pretty significant factor. The council didn't want the shortage we didn't, but the shortage is there. I'm going to go to Road and Weed. Sorry? 11:30.
Yes.
Yes, okay, right, I'll keep that. Last week I was reasonably polite about planning for the roads. I'm going to be slightly less polite today. My submission, between them, when it comes to planning for roads in this district, QLDC and the NZT in combination are appalling. It just is extraordinary. I'm going to take you through the journey here, because we've been trying to find out what's going on about planning for roads. I said to you last week, QLDC didn't designate for either Cattle Bridge, New Bridge, didn't designate the Eastern Artillery ramp around the runway, didn't designate this road link in the district plan. Spent 3 years planning the district plan review, and no one sat down and thought about a road. And then we have, and I'll go to my attachments. I didn't cover this put up in the witness sessions, but I want to emphasize it. Attachment E, paragraph 4.14 is from Ms. Banks, evidence in chief, where she refers to the area was subject to an application by council for funding under the HIF. Decision made in 2017. Application sought funding for transportation infrastructure upgrades to support a possible 1150 residential units. And isn't it the same figure that Ms. Banks concluded the roundabout question? I'm not quite sure that those are connected or not. Including a possible internal road alignment and connection to the East Arterial Road as identified in the figure below. And then you have figure one, the proposed Quail Rise Development Corridor with Queensland's Urban Development Area. Then you have a road that comes off the highway at the roundabout, goes straight north. There's a right angle turn to the east that connects to Quail Rise, and off it is an arm to the left, which you can see goes through and connects to Hampson Road, where there's an intersection. I think the word says construct intersection. And then head down towards the highway. That evidence is dated May 2017. May. Over the page, F, there's her rebuttal evidence, dated July 2017. Once again, she refers to the same road that she mentions connecting to Hampson Road, see figure 8. At this time, this road is preliminary and the outcomes of the HIF are not known. This is the end of July. Evidence is dated July. Same diagram, same road. Go to the next page. This is only GG because in my legal speech it's only attached 3 pages and called it G, and I now attach 6 pages and called it GG, but it's the same logic. Look at the road, it's in blue. That's dated March 2017. Because on the final page, of that, and then shift. This is through me, 28 March 2017. So that is the application, completed in March 2017. And if you read that, I'm just going to touch it, go GG, location of housing being enabled, the location of projects, it's called the Quail, what they call it Quail Rise South or something, rather than Franklin Place North, but if you go back to the front page, you can see that what they call Quail Rise South is, well, it's kind of weird actually. It includes some of Quail Rise land, which isn't something to be zoned in the top corner. Now, it doesn't, I think it excludes the arm thing. But it's basically the same area. Total funding requested, 10.3 million for transport, water supply and wastewater. The transport's for road. And then over the page, description of proposal, Quail Rise South, residential development. Access to the SH6 and Tucker Beach Road intersections. And then it is proposed to construct a road linking Perryhill Drive to the newly formed roundabout junction of SH6 and Hawthorne Drive. No mention, answer up. My point here is that application was made and lodged in March 2017. That blue road. And in May and July, under evidence, Ms. Banks produces an entirely different diagram, which she says is part of this HIA application, which isn't, which has a link to Hampson Road, which isn't mentioned anywhere else. And I happen to know because the person putting the HIF proposal together was Claire Devlin, who's invading to talk about the views of my clients. Who's in the planning department? Who's in the space? Or anybody in there talks to each other. So I just highlight the fact that that evidence of Ms. Banks and that road, I'm going back to E and F. Now, this diagram comes out of nowhere. The only explanation given was that it was part of the HIF application, which it wasn't. discussed in this evidence. And if you look at it, look at the diagram of the evidence, you might reflect if you walk the land. I mean, the length of quite a large is okay. To get to Hanson Road, there's a significant increase in elevation. There's a pumping road gully that you can't walk down the sides of it. You can need a bridge to get across. And it goes through two of those residential lots, the Hanson residential lots that were conceded in March of this year, during which, incidentally, there was no mention of this proposed road when those lots were conceded. And what's even weirder, if you think about it, if you see where it connects to Hanson Road, you go down to the flats at the bottom where the school is, and you have another rezoning proposal down there. Well, all of that development down there is always going to access the highway to Hanson Road intersection. It's existing legal road. Hanson's here, can't stop that. And there is evidence before you that they're proposing to four-lane it and put a concrete barrier so you can't turn right over Hanson Road. So none of the development down there is going to use this quite expensive road. And north of that intersection, there are four existing houses, one of which is a mutual road and this year is mine, so
I live up there.
We did a site visit. Yeah, four existing houses. And the four proposed houses of the Hanson Road. Now, you know, it's going to be eight houses, a lovely choice, down Hanson Road and then go that way, or down the other way and end up at the other end of it. Where was the rationale behind the suggestion that anyone would even think of wanting to build this road?
I'll just look at the map. The Arnott's land, most of the Hanson Road is well to the south of west of southwest of, you know, the Hawthorne Road roundabout. And they're going to have to have a, maybe not that long, but they're going to have to come in off that roundabout somehow.
So I can say again that the,
if you look at that. The blue land and the orange there. I'm going to get back. Use that as a road that the council now has got. It's paid for approval.
Correct. And in fact,
they'll have to have some form of roading into their block. Because they can't come straight out on the state highway for development.
Correct. So, in fact, I'm going to come with some road designs in the moment, but.
We're not the only one, but there has to be something to access those two blocks.
Yes. And there will need to be a road, a little sub road that comes off the roundabout and goes west to the boundary of that, to the boundary of the other property. I agree with you. For those lands to be developed, there will need to be a slight sub road off to that side.
There won't be a slight sub road. You can sort of cul-de-sac, serving probably possibly hundreds of roads.
Yes, no, okay. There will need to be a road.
There might be a little one for a college. But the amount of land we serve off one road.
Well, I'll be Mr. Carr answer that. But regardless of that, from the roundabout through to the Arnott land, it's very easy, very straightforward, it's an easy road. To get from the Arnott land through to Hanson Road, this. Because you probably can't go through the Transpower substation.
No,
it's actually quite significant.
It would be nice to hook up to Grant Road, but you've got the Transpower.
Yeah, anyway. You've got to go up, across the gully, and join Hanson Road. And it's feasible. It certainly is cheap. And the rationale escapes me. Now, given that I am current self obligations to the TAP, although I have criticised Ms. Banks' diagram for having no apparent genesis. I should share with the panel, but it is my understanding that this means NZTA plan. I have seen it before. I say that because I know you hear it from NZTA downtrack. I believe it's NZTA. I don't know when it was prepared, I don't know why it was prepared, I don't know what status it has. It's kind of been thrown around. But I think it's an NZTA plan. Having said that, there's no evidence before you, one. And the reason I've reinforced this issue is that one of the banks's proposed provisions is that there can't be any development of this land unless that link, that link happens. That's my concern when I come to the end about what she proposes, is that the Hanson Road is in her provisions is critical. And my solution to you is that there's simply no evidence for it whatsoever.
Yes? Mr.
Goldsmith.
Funding, if it comes, is from the Housing Infrastructure Fund. Does that mean that the land has to be so residential in order for the council to borrow the money and build the wrap on the roundabout to Crown Drive? Because if it was a BMU zone, there's no guarantee which way it would deliver housing, which is the purpose of the Housing Infrastructure Fund. I don't know the answer, I was just sitting here staring at it, wondering.
I am involved in not only this project but a much more significant one up at Temple Wallet, which is affected by that fund, and nobody knows anything about it. We've been trying to find whether there's been a political announcement of funding the sovereign structure, and so it's money has been kind of approved. There's no available detail of confirmation of it, of how it's happened, what the conditions are, what the proposals are. There's nothing. So I can't answer your question. And I have been trying to find out. The government hasn't released any information. And if you talk to the MD officials, there's nothing, they're working on it.
It's odd because there's been announcements of three. I think with the SHA sort of status, Universal Development, which is here, Kingston, and some properties in Lady Smile, and I had in my own mind connected the Housing Infrastructure Fund as being the means for accelerating the infrastructure to service those SHA. Did I? I mean, that's
yes,
no,
that's the state of intention. But I can't answer your question about the link between, because it gets even more complicated, as I'm about to demonstrate. The recommended zoning when you look at those houses.
That's where I'm
I'm coming to that. So, my next point relates to attachment. Now, the landowners have been working together, and it was our understanding some months ago that the fourth link to the roundabout was designed for the purpose of the link to Crown Drive, and that was considered to be very important by NZTA. Because of the problem with the Taka Beach decision. And Mr. Carr, in fact, will be able to tell you that some kind of list is here, right? But today people are concerned. So all of my clients have understood that there's going to be a road through here. The issue that we saw coming up was that, well, if there's going to be a road, when is there going to be a road, where is it going to be? It could just put a blight on development. So submission H is a submission lodged for the annual plan, 28 April 2017, on behalf of the combined solicitors. I won't go through the whole thing, but if you go to page 9, according to the solicitor's request, that the council approves in its annual plan provision the initiation and completion of the road designation procedure, linking the EAR roundabout Ferry Hill Drive and Quite Rise. And the council again the annual plan and this is a 10-year plan to provide the implementation of this road on that once the designation process has been completed. Basically, the landowner's saying, the background book basically says, well, with a bit of luck, this land will be rezoned in the next 9 months. We'd like to develop it, we'd like to know where this road's going to go and where the council wants it. If you're going to designate it. Which, given the HIF application, you might have some priority. As usually happens with submissions to the annual plan, there was no acknowledgement of receipt, and it was ignored. And you check it in your plan, and there's no provision for participation. So,
there's a critical issue with the road of this nature. To protect the root of it by one means or another, a designation of one means. But what you've done for is something during a subdivision that makes it impossible to build them.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
Which is precisely why we must get submission.
So designation is one possible. Another one is widely used when you've got multiple landowners as a tractor plan.
Is that
tractor plan?
Yes, aware of that. The difficulty I have the structure plan is, apart from this road, in fact, I've come into a plan with my assist you here.
You see, as of this panel, we can't ensure a designation of this panel.
No,
all you're telling us is background.
Yes, I agree.
We could go down more structure plan.
I'm coming to something that I insist. In fact, let's go without an extra. Why? There's a fully designed roadway. The road lines Hanson Trust, FIA Holdings, and Universal Villains. They put their heads together. And given all the background, given the submission, and actually designed the road, I think, this is an internal plan, which links up around, this is the transfer of Pi 1, which the HIF road goes right through, and heads across to the point where it crosses the FII and Universal Developments. Now, it only goes so far, but at the end of the day, these three landowners are trying to sort out the situation between themselves so that they can. So, once it gets to the boundary, it's Universal's job to go on, and as long as the bit in the middle happens. And there is, I can actually use, there is another plan with a little leg going out to the left to the outer boundary. As I said, this is just an internal plan between the parties trying to reach an agreement on crossing points, which has been reached. And so it's a plan that those two landowners are happy with. They'd like the council to designate it. And I'm thinking on my feet. I'll come back to that structure plan issue. But at the moment, I'm not seeing a huge disadvantage of that, to be honest.
Well, do you want me to take you with that 11:30? It's a good time to stop so that you can. Okay, for a minute or two.